Journalist Abigail Schreier is no stranger to controversy. She hit the topic of rapid-onset gender dysphoria hard in her first best-selling book, Irreversible Damage. Recently, she released a new book, Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up, which calls out therapeutic practices which she believes hurt rather than help our kids. Stick with us as I chat with counselors Julie Lowe and Dr. Phil Monroe to get their take on Schreier's new book on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, and today we're going to have a conversation about a book that's getting a lot of traction, I believe, both on the internet and it's selling rather well, from my understanding. We just a little bit of background here. We try to read widely here, and we're committed to tracking with some of the latest research and analysis that comes out on children, teens, and families. And we're not just committed to listening to those who are addressing these issues from a Christian perspective, but those in the mainstream realm who are offering up perspectives which can at times mesh well with a Christian worldview. We really believe that all truth is God's truth, so we're looking for some voices that will help us understand and respond in ways that glorify God and promote well-being of kids and families. And so some of the voices that I've tracked with or been listening to over the last few years that I know we've talked about here on the podcast in the past who have been helpful in some way, shape, or form are people like Jonathan Haidt, Gene Twenge, Greg Lukianoff. That's a tough last name to say. Miriam Grossman, David Brooks, and then Abigail Schreier. You may be familiar with journalist Abigail Schreier's common sense expose regarding rapid onset gender dysphoria, and it was a 2021 book that she wrote, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. I was away this weekend and at a church in New York, and that was a topic of conversation as people were trying to navigate that and, you know, what is legitimate gender dysphoria and what is social contagion, and so she wrote a lot about that. In February of this year, Schreier released a new book that's really caught the attention of many, including youth workers we've talked to, pastors, counselors, and parents. And the book is titled Bad Therapy, subtitled Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. And in it, she looks at the role that she believes current approaches to therapy, education, and parenting are playing and actually making the rising tide of poor mental health that we read about among our kids worse rather than better. So she's looking for causes to why things are getting so bad in terms of the statistics that we know and then even many of the personal stories. So I've read the book, and I've recommended that youth workers read it because I found in there some common sense. You know, it's sort of a, in many ways related to parenting, I would say, but I was curious about her take on therapy and counseling. And so after receiving some pushback from some folks who, they had not actually read the book, but they responded instead of the book's title, they thought it was a diatribe against all therapeutic efforts. I thought, let's have a conversation about the book with some people who have read it, who are counselors, and they're two of our highly respected go-to counselor friends here at CPYU, Julie Lowe and Dr. Phil Monroe. And if you're unfamiliar with them, just very briefly, Julie Lowe's no stranger to our Youth Culture Matters audience, and even to those who have attended the Northeast Youth Ministry Summit. Julie's been there the last 2 years. She's an author, a speaker, and a counselor with over 25 years of experience, and she served for several years as a faculty member at the Christian Counseling and Education Foundation, has also lectured and taught at Westminster Theological Seminary and Missio Seminary. She's written several books. You can find them on our website. We'll include links to those on the show notes for this episode, and you can learn more about Julie and her resources at julielowe.org. Julie, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I made the mistake today. I had never done this before. I actually looked at julielowe.com, and I didn't realize you'd become a concert pianist.
So I know. I have many talents.
And then I'm going to introduce Phil. I did the same thing with Phil a few years ago. There's a guy named Phil Monroe who's like a comic book creator or a humorist. But Dr. Phil Monroe, who's joining us, is a Christian psychologist. Phil has been on before. He was the director of the Master of Arts in Counseling and Related Programs in the Graduate School of Counseling at Missio Seminary. And he was part of creating the Global Trauma Recovery Institute. We'll want to hear more about that. It works to train those interested in facilitating trauma recovery in cultures outside their own. And he teaches globally. He's going to be leaving for Morocco in a couple of days and represents the Trauma Healing Institute at the American Bible Society. And he is currently in partnership, we were excited to hear about this, with Dr. Diane Langberg, one of our friends at Langberg Monroe and Associates in Jengetown, Pennsylvania, private counseling practice. You can learn more about Phil and his resources at philipmonroe.com. Not philmonroe.com, but philipmonroe.com. So welcome, Phil. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Yes, I don't have anything to do with Bugs Bunny, but I do know something about Trump.
Yeah, I don't know if that guy that because we joked about that the last time. I can't remember. I don't think it was Bugs Bunny, but he was quite an accomplished cartoonist. So I was. Yeah, you learn. I have not like Googled my name. Well, there was one guy with my name who was a baseball player from probably about 100 years ago, but that's about it for my name. So this is a conversation I've wanted to have, and I thought, you know, the title of the book, let's start with this, because Phil was joking when we were trying to get this thing kicking, and we were emailing back and forth to find a time to record. He said he's always up for a good debate, and that made me a little bit nervous. I'm not much of a debater, but I thought, okay, this will be good. I'll get some pushback on maybe my read on this particular book, and I'm sure there are things in there I need pushback on. I'm sure there's things we can agree are helpful. But I want to start with this question to the two of you, because the title is Bad Therapy. Is there a difference for the two of you, either of you or both, between therapy and counseling? This is just a personal question I've had. Is there a difference between therapy and counseling? Are they interchangeable terms?
Yeah, how would you answer that, Phil?
Oh, that's great. Well, Julie turns it right over to Phil. I love it.
I used to teach a course called History and Systems of Psychology and Counseling. So in modern day speak, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between these terms anymore. There used to be, and there are different turf involved here. Counseling was seen more as advising, things like that, maybe more of educational side of things, whereas therapy was much more looking at maybe the psychoanalytic tradition, you know, unconscious. But if you talk to people, we use those words quite interchangeably, psychotherapy, therapy, counseling, mental health care. They all cover a lot of the same sorts of things.
Okay, that's helpful. I don't want to use the wrong terms, and especially in the realm of Christian counseling, which I know, is marked by some very unique approaches. I was just curious about that and wondered if those terms are actually interchangeable now. So the two of you have both been counseling for quite some time, counseling individuals, counseling families, counseling children, teenagers. Would you agree with the basic, you know, assessment of the book regarding the growing tide of poor mental health among children and teens? Are you seeing that? And how specifically have you seen that from where each of you sit?
Yeah, I'll start. I definitely see it. And it's interesting, even when you're in the field, to know how many of your peers would agree or disagree with what the concerns are, and especially with young people. You know, what makes the book so appealing is I think it's pointing to some truth, that there is bad therapy counseling out there, that there is a way in which young people are self-diagnosing, over-diagnosing, taking therapy language and turning it into everyday talk. And one of the things I consistently say is when we mislabel something, we mishandle it. And so you can mislabel something as trauma or abuse that isn't, and then you mishandle it. And you can label something and say it's not trauma or abuse and mishandle it. You see that with teens all the time with bullying. That language of bullying is so overused, it's starting to mean nothing anymore. You see that with gaslighting. I hear kids all the time tell each other they're gaslighting each other. I think you guys don't even know what that means. So you are seeing this struggle with the everyday therapy language entering into day to day and how people respond to things. And I think what the book starts to point to is things that I actually would call problems in parenting just as much as I would counseling as well.
Yeah, I want to circle back to that. Phil, what about you in your practice? And I know I always feel weird asking people about what they're seeing in their practice because we don't want to break any confidence or things. But generally, you know, as you study what's happening, as you see what's happening in the lives of families, children and teens, would you be in agreement with, you know, Schreier's comments and her analysis of, you know, hey, this is getting to be, it's like a tidal wave almost in terms of, you know, mental health issues among our children and teens?
Yeah, I would say that the percentages of children coming to our practice are about the same. We actually probably have an increase in adults coming these days, but I would agree that in general, based on what we're seeing, you know, there is an increase in reports of anxiety and depression and distress and trauma that certainly have COVID time since then has seems to have gone at a higher rate. And I would say also there with that new information, maybe that people have really playing off of what Julie said, is that there is a greater interest in naming what it is. So, you know, naming it as a diagnosis and not so much always to treat it, but to name it as an identifier, which I find interesting. You know, we see pendulum swings here, right? We go from not talking about things like trauma and mental health disorders to talking about it in a particular way that doesn't seem as helpful sometimes. Because it's more of an identifier that I label that I have that really is part of my identity.
Yeah. I'm thinking about that, you know, as you both mentioned, self-diagnosis, that Miriam Grossman in her book, Lost in Transnation, she's saying, you know, about the medical establishment that kids come in with a diagnosis, they self-diagnose and immediately without much time to ask a lot of questions or, hey, let's start with, you know, why you think this and that sort of thing. They will very quickly, I know in some cases, not all, jump into basically, you know, saying, all right, you're transgender. We're going to start the process, whatever that involves at this point. And, you know, that's who you are. You've self-diagnosed. So I believe that. Would you say in the world of, you know, mental health professionals, Christian counselors, and even youth workers and parents who are hearing from their kids, hey, I'm this or hey, I'm that, they're self-diagnosing, that there's good reason to pause and to ask a lot of questions before moving quickly down that road?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Frankly, I don't see a lot of people coming in and immediately wanting to take a diagnosis, give a child a medication. You know, the book kind of suggests that the kids are being over-medicated, and I suspect that there is a population of kids who are. But by and large, parents don't want to put their children on medications, and by and large, I don't find that kids are taking them in massive quantities too quickly. Julie, you might have a different experience of that.
No, well, I mean, probably because you have eyes on the way things are handled in your practice and probably the way we think is similar. But I see, going back to what you said, Phil, about COVID and the epidemic of anxiety and stress, and that our kids, I think they're exposed to more. So I think there's reason to be feeling more anxious. So that leads into social media and media in general and the way of society, but I think what I do hear a lot of is the labeling, the words being thrown out, not from counselors, but from, like you said, parents and teens and children. And my concern is counselors are also accepting that because we don't want to offend, we don't want to go against, which leads to, this could be controversial, I think this does lead to a bad therapy practice, is that I'm sensing a change that when young people, probably all people, come to therapy, that they don't want to be challenged, they want to be affirmed. So that makes it incredibly hard for counselors, therapists to press in maybe on poor ways of thinking or mislabels, because if the trend in the belief system is my counselor should be affirming me, not pushing against, you know, my thoughts and opinions, then we're just accepting diagnoses, we're accepting self-diagnoses, and then treating them as such.
That's a really interesting point you make there, Julie, that just the whole thing about I'm coming in and I'm coming here for counseling, I'm coming here for therapy, but what I want for you to do is to affirm me. And it seems to me that would be symptomatic of the kinds of things that are happening in the culture, even that, you know, Schreier writes about, where we don't want to, you know, you think about therapeutic parenting, and, you know, we'll get to the parenting thing after a break, but, you know, parents, the whole idea about, I don't want to make things too tough for my kids. So possibly a kid comes into a situation where they need counseling and they're with a counselor, and the counselor is not affirming them. And, you know, I'll use some of the terms that, get, you know, we might hear now, oh, you're triggering me, or oh, you're committing violence against me. This is a microaggression. You're not affirming me. Could that be happening? I'm just wondering if that's a possibility with this, as you sit with families and teens and kids.
It can be happening. I think validation and affirmation are wonderful things. We all need them. Mm-hmm. But sometimes a good idea is only superficially understood and then used in ways that isn't actually helpful in the long run. And I find that quite frequently about a lot of mental health, you know, ideas, is that we'll get a kind of superficial TikTok version of something, yes, you know, that is applied as if it is the thing when it's just part of a thing. So I have my clients, they need validation, but that doesn't mean we're stopping at validation as if that's the last stop on the bus line, right? That's the beginning of, okay, so now what do we want to do? How do you want to live? Who are you going to be? Where do you want to work, right? There's an action step that goes. So validation is the beginning and the foundation, but it certainly is not the end.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to move people beyond that. And I think, you know, related to parenting, the same thing there. Obviously, Schreier's talking about, you know, basically this failure to launch and to function as an independent adult and continue to be dependent because there's no resilience or ability to do that. And so that's that missing action step, that next step you're talking about. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're chatting with Dr. Phil Monroe, Julie Lowe, both counselors, and we're building our conversation around this book from Abigail Schreier. It's just out for a couple of months now, Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy listening to Youth Culture Matters and would like to support the ongoing efforts of this ministry, you can do so by visiting cpyu.org/giving to make a donation. Your prayers and financial support make this podcast possible.
Hey, we're back and continuing our chat with Julie Lowe, Dr. Phil Monroe. And Phil, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, you sort of prompted this, is, you know, I was thinking about your international travel, which you're doing quite a bit of that, and heading to Morocco. I'm curious if what we see here in the U.S. and what's being reported as this, you know, growing tide of rising tide of mental health issues among children and teens. Is that unique here to the United States, or is it, do you see it globally?
Well, I would say this is that the work we're doing, especially with clergy and helping them understand trauma, that trauma is real. It's a universal thing that happens around the world. For kids and teens, I think they don't have as much access to some of the social media apps that maybe our kids have. And so there is maybe more resilience and more needing to be in survival mode. So mental health problems are universal, but how they play out obviously changes, especially when adolescents and teens have to be much more involved in their family's life for survival.
Yeah, that's helpful. I want to shift into the parenting realm, because she writes about parenting and the failure of parenting, what she calls therapeutic parenting, which she would define or describe as kind of a soft parenting that is motivated by a desire to have a happy child who has never experienced pain, discomfort, fights failure, and absolutely, as she says, no hint of trauma. And by the way, she puts trauma in quotes there. Let's talk first about what you're seeing in changes in parenting. And there are some genuine concerns about that. You know, we often talk generation to generation. You know, I always wonder about what my grandparents thought about the way my parents parented me, what my parents thought about the way we parented our children. And now in my mind, you know, I have an idea of how my parents or my kids are parenting my grandkids. And it just seems like, you know, every generation questions the next. But are you seeing changes that should be cause for concern that actually could be contributing to the mental health crisis?
Yeah, I would answer that by a wholehearted yes to that. And I think there are a couple of factors. And I'll date myself by saying I think parents are drinking the Kool-Aid. We're buying into all the societal beliefs, and you know, it's easy to pick on social media and technology, but Phil brought this up earlier, but that definitely is huge to why even kids are more aware of mental health things. And we can argue there's good things behind that. There's a whole lot of negative, but you know, parents are, they're putting their kids into situations where they're not equipped to swim against the tide. So I use the swimming analogy all the time, that when you teach a child to swim, you're in the water with them, you're holding them, you're helping them. And then as they get better swimmers, they can handle deeper waters or they can handle deeper situations. So our job isn't to shelter them. Our job is not to forbid them. Our job is to equip them. I want to equip them to go into the world and navigate technology, to navigate mental health, to navigate all these things. But unfortunately, I think where parents are clueless is they don't understand the tide that they're asking their children to swim in anymore, that the current is so, so strong, that they are naive to giving their kids a cell phone that opens up a world of dangers and cool things. But I think as parents, we're buying into this permissiveness and that being an authority somehow is wrong because we're so afraid of being called authoritarian or helicopter parenting, or we're so afraid of the labels that we are willing to abdicate our God-given roles in healthy ways. So gentle parenting, she brings that up in the book. And I know I have mixed views on gentle parenting. I've seen gentle parenting that is highly relational and loving and still authoritative. And I've seen people call what they do gentle parenting that's highly permissive and unhelpful and not, they've given up authority and given it over to their kids. So what kind of parenting are we actually talking about? We're good at labeling things and labeling people in ways that we constantly feel the need to react to.
Mm. I was thinking about that. If I could just add in, my issue with this book is generally that she sees problems, but then takes a hatchet to it.
Yeah.
And I do think, to Julie's point, the issue is about permissive versus gentle parenting. There is some really good tools out there that are called gentle parenting. But what I'm seeing is actually just a superficial understanding of that. And it's much more of a passive parenting where there's abdication. That's not what gentle parenting is supposed to be about. So that's one of the challenges that we have here is maybe underlying that, this belief that I can protect my kids from trauma and all harm, but we don't know what to do since we're struggling with that. I can try or I can just give up.
Mm. Phil, let me follow up on that because of all your work with trauma. And I know both of you have worked in this area, and I don't want to miss an opportunity to tap into your expertise here. Are we, I'm not sure what the word is, are we labeling too many things as traumatic? Are we looking at things that are not traumatic and labeling them as traumatic, or saying to kids, yes, you've experienced trauma, when in fact it might just be the normal, you know, comings and goings and difficulties of life that, you know. So I think about, like, what I think was Julia mentioned earlier on, like bullying, you know, that you know, if someone looks at you funny, now you've been bullied, and maybe you feel like violence has been committed against you, whereas, you know, in the past, your parents might say to you, now I sound like an old guy, but, you know, get over it and, you know, get back in there and, you know, work it out, you know, and those kinds of things that stretch us and build resilience. So my question, to go back to it, is have we expanded the, you know, the definition of trauma to include things that really are not traumatic? Help
probably
us understand that. Yeah,
probably so. Trauma is an experience, not an event. And what we really mean by that is something that has a chronic negative effect on me long after it's over, or in a continuing way. Now, we all go through distressing things that might affect us for a little while. What really matters here in the conversation is the kind of support that somebody's having and the kind of community they're in. Does it acknowledge the pain, and does it help them re-engage their world? But not everything is post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Even though some people might have some ongoing sensations, experiences that they're struggling to make sense of and cope with.
Mm.
I think if we have any kind of emotional reaction, you're hearing people say, well, I'm triggered, or it's PTSD. And we're using that language so commonplace that I think it waters down people who really are experiencing those things. And it waters down the meaning of those things.
You know, one of the things that she talks about is the absence, the growing absence of resiliency as young people come of age, and things that, as I mentioned earlier, might stress us, you know. And, you know, Julie, what you said about the swimming, you know, moving a little bit further away from our kids and allowing them to struggle a bit on their own to learn to swim. I mean, the same thing, you've heard the metaphors of exercise and, you know, practice and stretching, you know, your muscles and doing damage to your muscles so that they get stronger, so to speak. But do either of you or both of you feel that we've lost that ability to be resilient, or that's diminished quite a bit? And what can we do to encourage a recovery of that, both to parents, and I'm thinking about youth workers as well who are listening?
Yeah, I'll jump in, and then, yeah, Phil, you can piggyback off of that or disagree. I don't know. I don't often think of the word resilient. And maybe that's just how my mind works. I don't think of resiliency. I mean, I'm a parent of five. We've been a foster parent for 20 years, an adoptive parent. I mean, talk about real issues to work through with your kids' stories. And I just don't think about the language of resiliency, but I do think about helping make sense out of their experiences and their stories. And, you know, that's where I think maybe the book misses the spiritual aspect of this too, that hard things happen in our lives, even trauma happens in our lives as part of our stories, but it doesn't have to become our identity. And that's what I think goes amok, that it becomes people's identity. And how we help them process that is what really matters. So there is an ownership on the adults, primarily parents, but even counselors, to say we either weaponize it or we make people perpetual victims. or we minimize it, but how we help them process it, and which is, I guess, resiliency, right? But how we help people process their stories is really what matters.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think we were better off when we didn't talk about any of these things, or when we allowed people to be bullied. You know, yeah. I don't think we were better off. We did need a vocabulary, but the question is, how do we live and how do we exemplify that conversation with our kids, you know, showing that we're going through hard things, talking about it really, but then talking about how we find help in the Lord, right? Mm-hmm. And in our faith communities to continue.
I like that. And I'm glad you brought in the spiritual element. I knew we'd get there eventually with this. And this is, for me, what sets apart, you know, really good youth ministry for those who are youth workers who are listening. And then qualified Christian counseling, because when we talk about that here, we always put the word qualified in front of the word Christian, which is followed by the word counseling. And I think that, you know, qualified Christian counselors do what you two just mentioned. And I think, you know, you're talking about a good theology, a working theology of suffering, understanding the place of that in our spiritual lives in a fallen world, the side of the new heavens and the new earth. And to give our kids perspective on that, you know, I think about a lot of what I read, you know, in our reform circles, which talks about, you know, this is for my good and God's glory, that kind of thing. And so a good theology of suffering. And that's certainly one thing that I think is missing, obviously, in this book, but in the larger world in terms of how we, you know, how we navigate these things. I mean, I think good parents allow their kids to suffer. You don't want to see your kids suffer, but when they do suffer, you know, we know that that's going to, you know, build them up in the Lord as they engage in thinking through that biblically and looking at the scriptures on that and praying through that. So I appreciate the two of you saying that. Let me ask you about this. This was interesting because there was a whole chapter on this, and it really is a world. Since I'm not involved in education now the way I was when my own kids were in school, but the whole notion of defining or what social and emotional learning is and defining that, she's a whole chapter on that. When you two read that, was there anything in that that caused concern for you? And I'm just going to read here, for those who are unfamiliar with what social and emotional learning are. Definition is the process through which children, adolescents, and adults learn skills to support healthy development of relationships. Adult and student social and emotional learning competencies include self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision-making. And, I mean, there's nothing there that really, you know, leaves me thinking, oh, this is a bad thing. But what Schreier is talking about is how in the educational world, there's all these emotional check-ins all the time. You know, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Getting beyond, you know, teaching what teachers have been called to do and doing this. And I had a conversation with a public school teacher that I know fairly well, a high school teacher, and I brought this up and I said, help me understand this. And he said to me, how he responded was, yeah, my kids who have the anytime pass. And the anytime pass is a pass they have where if in the moment, anything that's happening in the classroom, whether it be something that's being talked about, the temperature in the room, or perhaps some questions on a test that they don't exactly like or can't answer, the student can get up and just leave. They can just leave, you know, anytime. That's the anytime pass. So now that sounds like an extreme, I know, related to social and emotional learning, but as you read that, did you either of you have any response to that as to how this might be contributing to the issues she's writing about, to the mental health, the decline in mental health amongst our kids, or just, you know, as parents, you know, what do you think of that?
So I thought of an analogy when I read that. There's a lot of bad theology and biblical studies out there, right?
Yep.
But we certainly wouldn't diminish the science of and the work of good theology and good biblical studies. the way she writes is to take some examples like that and smear a whole area of social and emotional learning. Now, is there a reason to do that? Because is there some places where there are too many people having the anytime pass or things like that? That might be so. Because often we take a good thing, and in order to apply it everywhere, we just apply some superficial version of it. And now it's actually not doing the thing that we need it to do, right? And it's having an effect that we didn't want to have. So maybe that's possible, but I suspect that this is probably not what most kids are having as a daily function, at least the ones that we're talking about. Now, kids who are in special, special education, right, and or getting some adaptations, maybe that needs to be looked at on how easily are they, you know, using emotions to avoid the learning process. Mm.
Yeah, and I would say I do think that's happening a lot. But to Phil's point, the problem in the book isn't that there's not truth to what she's saying. She just doesn't nuance like what makes their real needs. There are real needs and IEPs and accommodations needed.
Yep.
And what distinguishes from those that are not. And that's, I think, where the problem lies. So she's pointing to things that I think are happening. I just think she's not doing a good job of explaining why they're happening. And so what's the hope of solution? Where is the solution, right?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, we're going to take our last break, come back, and I'm going to get some final thoughts from you on how to read this book. For those who have read it already, give us some parameters for how to read it. I'm going to lean into Phil. He said something before we started to record that I thought was great on that, but hear from both of you on that. And then for those who may pick up the book to read it, how to read it perhaps more cautiously and how to glean from it that which will be helpful. So we'll be right back. Hey there, Youth Culture Matters listeners. We've been told that one of our best-kept secrets here at CPYU is our one-minute daily podcast, Youth Culture Today. Each and every weekday, we release a new episode that's timely, practical, and hope-filled, all for an audience of parents, youth workers, and anyone else who cares about kids. Here's a sample from one of our recent Youth Culture Today episodes.
Youth Culture Today with Walt Mueller of the Center for Parent Youth Understanding.
In this day and age where we are hearing more and more about the declining mental health of our kids, we need to come to an understanding of how changes in the nature of childhood are contributing to this epidemic. One of the clear causes has been the move from kids engaging in what's called free play to kids engaging in only adult-supervised organized sports or remaining sedentary by spending so much time on screens. The Aspen Institute tells us that the benefits of childhood play are immediate and long-term. Kids who physically play are physically and mentally healthier. They perform better in school, they are less likely to engage in drug use and other risky behaviors, and wind up being more productive as they move into the adult years. Additional research tells us that going outside to engage with friends in free play leads to greater resiliency for kids as they learn how to relate with others and solve problems. Make it possible for your kids to play in this way.
For more on youth culture, visit us on the web at cpyu.org.
Youth workers, do your parents a favor and get them to subscribe to Youth Culture Today, wherever they get their podcasts. Well, in this last segment we have with Julie and Phil, I want to get a little more practical. I've loved their insights here, but I want to get a little more practical about how to read this book. If you've read it already, how to maybe go back and process what you've read, how to glean from it what's good, or if you're planning on reading it, what can you glean from it? And Phil, you had some good advice there, I think, you were talking about. I'd love to hear from Julie on it as well. But what would be your recommendations on how to best read the book?
Well, I think she, like many authors, writes her books so that she can sell copies. And so to do that, you've got to kind of paint a black and white world. You've got to say things in stark terms. And maybe that's necessary for us to get our conversation starting. But as Julie said, previously, it doesn't really lead us to solutions. And it paints really a hyperbole of what good therapy might look like, right? I'd rather see a book on that. What's the difference between good and bad therapy? Because all we get here is a picture of people who just want to see you for as many times as they can to make as much money as they can to affirm all of your feelings. And that's just not what I've seen as therapy over the, 35 years or so that I've been working.
Yeah. And you know, to as a response to that, Phil, you know, you're working in a place where there's people are diligent, you know, engaging in counseling and therapeutic practices that are godly, you know, and I think, and again, I wonder, because, you know, we're going to talk about this, how to choose somebody if you're looking for a counselor, especially for parents. And I was looking this morning at the expansion and the proliferation of these online therapy sites. I was watching a baseball game the other night, and I think I saw 3 or 4 commercials on mental health and, you know, finding some help online. So things like Brightside, Calmary, Talkspace, et cetera. I'm seeing these commercials, and that, I mean, should we be troubled about that or cautious about that? I can't for the life of me imagine that this would be a positive thing all the time. You know, maybe you'd hit on someone who would be very helpful, but, you know, as counselors, therapists, how would you recommend with that? You know, what do we do with those? I mean, do you recommend people go to those?
I'm pretty concerned about the proliferation here. Now, if you're in, I don't know, Montana, and you don't have anything really available near you, then I could understand using that. But I'm very concerned about the quality of care, the kind of connection that you could build with something like that.
Yeah. You know, and just as we cited social media and the internet as something that, you know, is just makes ideas go viral, right? I think being able to get a quote unquote counseling degree has been made easy too. I think anybody who wants to get a counseling degree could probably do it pretty easily on the internet, and that concerns me too. You know, theology degrees as well. But Julie, you have any thoughts on that with these sites?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's good and bad, right, to everything. But you think about, we talk how much young people are being shaped and adults being shaped by pseudo relationships or doing relationships online. How can that not impact a therapeutic relationship as well then? So it's just asking better questions about what the pros and cons are, and should we just be using it across the board, or is there specific places that it is and should be used?
Yeah. That's good. That's good advice. Well, let me end with this question. There's so much more I'd love to talk about, but Phil has to get to Morocco. So we'll have a conversation again. I really want to have a time where we talk more about trauma. But for now, let's just some thoughts for parents, some thoughts for youth workers on how to know when professional counseling is required and should be sought, and then how to take the next step to find a good counselor or therapist. And I'd love to hear from both of you on that.
Well, I'll start out by saying, especially for parents, I mean, part of the struggle that this book is trying to bring out is we should be concerned with the parenting is being reshaped by the wrong paradigms, and that professionals are taking over the parenting. And that's highly problematic for me as a counselor as well, to say my job is to work myself out of a job. My job is to help come alongside parents, equip their kids, equip the parents. And so one thing I always tell parents to look for is, does your counselor involve you in the process? And that can look like a wide variety of ways of doing that. But if you're left out of the process, you should not be going to that counselor, because you're their wise counselor. You're there long term. And so a good counselor should be equipping you to know how to help your kids long term as well.
I would agree with that. If I see a kid for an hour a week, that's about as much as I'll ever do. Who's with them all the rest of the hours? Not me.
Right.
Now, we have issues around confidentiality and privacy, but those are not barriers to leave the parent out.
Right.
I like that. That's good advice. What about for youth workers, you know, And I think both of you have received emails from me multiple times. Diane Langberg has as well over the years. Like, hey, well, you know, we've got this situation here. We're looking for a counselor in this particular area or region of the country, or down, you know, both where both of you are down on the southeast portion of the state here. You know, trying to connect just because we want someone who is reputable. Any good advice besides emailing you like I do for youth workers for how to vet good counselors? And I recommend to youth workers that they do this before, as best they can, before they start getting phone calls or knocks on the door at 2 a.m. from distraught parents.
I agree. And I would say interview. Go interview the therapist. Take them out to lunch. Find out how they work. Ask around from your friends, family, neighbors, other people, who have they recommended in the past, and then go interview them. Those personal referrals are probably more important than just looking up a license or a website.
Yeah. Julie, any thoughts on that?
No, I agree. And you're right. Doing it beforehand and having a list of several different ones and finding out what things they're especially good at and specialize in, those things are really helpful. And not waiting till you're in the crisis to do that.
Yeah, so good. I'm going to ask you one more question, and this is very practical, and I'd love for both of you to answer this. But as we talk about parenting and just what's happening with parenting right now, I know, Julie, you have written several books. One is Child Proof, Parenting by Faith, Not Formula, and then also Safeguard, Shielding Our Homes and Equipping Our Kids. Those are two great parenting books. They're books we recommend here at CPYU. What other books would you recommend to the parents who are listening, or to the youth workers, to get into a library for parents that are, in your estimation, the best parenting books out there?
Well, the hard thing, why that's hard to answer for me is also it depends on what parents are struggling with, right? And so, you know, our parents struggling with adoption issues, or our parents struggling with anxiety, or our parents struggling just with overall parenting or building relationships with their teenagers. So I probably would answer that differently based on what is a parent wrestling with in stage of life and needs of their children.
What about general parenting? Let's say for you know, a couple that's ready to have their first child, or their children are growing up, entering into the adolescent years. There's no particular issue at this point that they're working to address that they've identified, but rather it's just a general sense of, you know, how to parent well, how to be a godly parent. Any recommendations there? I'm kind of pushing you, you know, just to see, but.
Well, Julie's the expert of that, but let me change your question.
Okay, good.
Be a politician. Answer the question I want to answer, not the one you're asking.
Yeah, and I'll take you out to lunch. I'll vet you, Phil. I'll get you out to lunch. I like that.
Okay. But I would say this, that start where you already know something about the scriptures.
Yes.
Start reading the scriptures through the lens of how does God respond to people in pain? And engage that. Have those conversations with your kids. So this is not the, you know, I'm about to have a child, you know, maybe, but the ones like, how do I talk to my kids about what's going on in the world? Well, I mean, the Bible is earthy. Start there. Look to see how God connects to people who are suffering, and have that conversation. There are a lot of materials out there like that. You don't have to be a psychologist, a counselor, to be able to have those conversations.
That's excellent. That's good. Good. Well, we are, let me wrap it up because I know both of you have to go. I so appreciate you giving of your time, and we value you here, both of you, in terms of your contributions to the kingdom and the way that you have been so helpful to us and to our constituency. Again, I want to recommend that you check out the websites for both Julie Lowe and Dr. Phil Monroe. You can find Julie at julielowe.org. Phil is at philipmonroe.com. We'll have links to those in the notes under the player for this particular episode on our website, cpyu.org. And I will just recommend both of them. I know they're traveling a lot. I know they have families. I know they have a lot of responsibilities. But if you are having an event where you would like to have someone come and address some of these issues, both Julie and Phil are doing that, and I would highly recommend that you tap into them as well. There's online resources from them as well. I know if you Google their names, lots of YouTube videos and helpful things that will speak to a lot of the matters that we talked about today. So thank you, Julie. Thank you, Phil, for being on.
My pleasure.
Yes, glad to be here.
And we will connect with everybody again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.